I'm George Riella from the Global History Center at the University of Warwick, and I'm here with Professor Nuno Senos for the Center for Overseas History at the New University of Lisbon, and this is part of the podcast of the Knowledge Center. Nuno, we are looking at a very strange, this is an image of a series of tiles. Can you tell us something about where these tiles are?
Yes, these tiles are found in the entry hall of the Franciscan convent of Recife, which is a city in Pernambuco, in northeastern Brazil. And I find it interesting that you react to them as being strange. Tiles, of course, are paramount in the Portuguese visual landscape. I don't find them strange at all, of course, because I was born surrounded by them, and I grew up surrounded by them. They're still part of today's Portugal, Portuguese landscape. What's interesting about tiles in Brazil is that, or one of the interesting aspects is that there was a law forbidding tiles to be made anywhere outside of continental Portugal, this in the colonial days, which of course protected the workshops mostly in Lisbon, which are the most active ones. So this particular panel was certainly made in Lisbon, sent across the ocean to Brazil, where it is displayed as part of a series of depictions of Franciscan martyrdoms in various parts of the world. This particular one depicts the martyrs of Nagasaki.
Oh, Nagasaki. So that's 1596.
Yes.
But this looks to me much later.
Yes, this is most likely mid-18th century, second half of the 18th century, perhaps a little later than the middle of the century.
So we have a representation of an event taking place more or less 150 years earlier in another continent, produced, reassembled in America out of tiles produced in Europe. This is truly a global object plus story.
Very much so. And in fact, the episode that is depicted is itself global. And the reason why I think they chose this episode is also very global.
Can you tell us something about the martyrdom itself?
Yes. At the end of the 16th century, the Jesuits that were getting to Japan via Portugal, Portugal was trading with Japan since the 1540s, they had acquired from the Pope the exclusive of the missionary work in Japan. And in 1596, Portugal and Spain were under the same king, Philip II, and the Franciscans from the Philippines got Philip's support to go to Japan and do missionary work there as well.
So they were competitors?
They were competitors, exactly. And an embassy was sent out. It actually included Franciscans, it included Jesuits, it included a couple of laymen as well, even though in this depiction they're all Franciscans. So this embassy goes to Japan, does missionary work. They are told to stop their missionary work and to leave Japan, which they do not, an order they don't obey to. And so they're eventually arrested. They are, I don't know if the exact order is, they're paraded in chains in Nagasaki or to Nagasaki, and then their ears get cut off. Each of them gets one ear cut off, or they get their ears cut off first and then they're paraded in chains, and eventually they're crucified and pierced, each of them pierced with two spears, as you can see on the right hand side of this image. And they are the martyrs of Nagasaki. They were beatified first and then eventually canonized by the Pope, and of course became a symbol of Christian sacrifice in the name of one's religion and one's religious beliefs. So that's what we have here.
So are there many representations of this martyrdom in Nagasaki?
There are several, yes. It was a martyrdom in general was something that several orders promoted and were keen on promoting. This particular one, because it took place, I guess, suppose because it took place so far away, and Japan was the farmost corner of the world at the time from a European point of view, Eurocentric point of view. I suppose maybe because of that, The martyrdom of Nagasaki was particularly resonant in both literature and images. Depictions were sent to the Vatican and they're still kept there, and there are depictions of these martyrs a little bit everywhere in the Portuguese world, at least.
But what is surprising in the sense is we're talking about 150 years later that still this image has such a powerful meaning. And of course, we are also talking of another continent now, the Americas. Why was it so important in Brazil in the mid-18th century?
Well, it's not only Brazil, it's this particular part of Brazil, Pernambuco, or the Northeast, and this part of the Northeast in particular, and the Franciscans. The Northeast its survival was based on the sugar economy, which in turn was based on slavery. You needed slaves to have the plantations and the sugar factories working. So there was an enormous non-white population. The indigenous population of this part of Brazil had been more or less entirely decimated by the mid-18th century, and the labor force was entirely non-white. By non-white, I mean Africans, or what they called at the time pardo, which is a word that means of mixed blood, all sorts of mixtures, black and white, and the subsequent mixtures. And we're talking about something between 75 and 80% of the population being non-white. In the middle of the 18th century, the Franciscans start becoming particularly concerned with this population, and they develop a number of strategies to provide them some sort of framing within the Catholic colonial world. And they do this by promoting the cults of non-white saints, including, or two of which were particularly visible. One of them was one of the martyrs of Nagasaki, a man called Gonçalo Garcia, Saint Gonçalo Garcia. Saint Gonçalo Garcia is yet another global fascinating story. He was the son of a Portuguese merchant who worked in India and was actually married to an Indian woman. And Gonçalo was himself a pardo, a man of mixed blood. And he learned the basics of his father's trade with him, traveling, sailing the Indian Ocean. He probably learned the basics of a number of languages around the Indian world, the Indian Ocean. And then eventually he makes it to Manila, where he converts, where he becomes a Franciscan. And that's how he gets integrated into this embassy, goes to Japan, and gets martyred in Japan, which is already itself a fairly global story. Then in the 18th century, when the Franciscans are looking for non-white Franciscan saints to promote in Brazil, they don't come up with many. They don't find that many. They do find this man, and they reinvent him in Brazil. He had already been canonized, so he was Portuguese, so he was perfect, or semi-Portuguese, so he was perfect for context, except that he wasn't mulatto, which is what they would have wished, or black, which is what they would have wished. So they reinvent him and sell him as a mulatto in Brazil. And there's a sermon which was published, that's how we know it, made by the chronicler of the Franciscans in 1753, I think, which was given at a mulatto church, so the Church of the Mulatto Brotherhood in Recife, in which the chronicler, a man called Jaguatão, addressing a Pardo nation, a Pardo audience, tells them that he took the pulpit that day to explain to this Pardo population that the days of their suffering are over. He is there to lead them into salvation by explaining them that mulattoes can also be saints. The road to holiness is also open to them. And he gives them a number of examples leading up to Gonçalo Garcia, who was the son of a European, therefore white, and of an Indian woman, therefore black. And that's where the magic begins, in which this Indian woman is converted into a black woman. Mm-hmm. and Gonzalo converted into a mulatto, a man of mixed blood, in the way mixed blood was understood in 18th century Brazil. Of course, he was of mixed blood, but not necessarily, and probably not, a mulatto in the strict sense of the word. But he becomes a mulatto in Jaboatão's sermon, which is an extraordinary sermon. He goes to the Bible and explains that Solomon is, that David is a mulatto as himself, son of the queen, Solomon, who's white, and the queen of Sheba, who was black. And he goes on finding biblical examples going all the way to Adam, who was made of clay. And of course, there is no such thing as white clay. Therefore, Adam himself was a mulatto. And this is one of the strongest moments in the promotion of this saint's cult in Brazil. There were others, there were public feasts, there were processions, there was an image that was put on a throne, there was all sorts of, there are paintings depicting him. In this particular panel, you can't really individualize any of the figures depicted, but the people who saw this panel, and it was placed in the entrance hall of the convent, so the public, the most public space, the space that to this day, it's where the poor are fed once a week for free by the Franciscans. So everybody would see this panel, and they would know what they were seeing, what they were being shown.
Is it common that it is actually on tiles? That is to say, is these themes common represented through tiles rather than through paintings or other media?
In the Portuguese world, yes.
Mm-hmm. And in Brazil, too?
In Brazil, especially. Brazil was the non-European Portuguese territory in which tiles were spread out the most. Let's put it this way. We know now, although most of them have been lost, we know there were tiles in India, in Portuguese churches in India. We know there were tiles in Malacca. We know there were tiles in other churches throughout Asia, but most of them disappeared, and we don't know much about those tiles. Brazil, on the other hand, it's still teeming with tiles. There are tiles everywhere in Brazil, all of them made in Lisbon. I would say, no one has done the math ever, to the best of my knowledge, but I would say that at least half of the production of 18th century Portugal, about half of the tile production, is in fact in Brazil. So yes, you find them in painting as well, but tiles are very common in Brazil, and tiles depicting martyrdoms are fairly common as well.
Well, it's a splendid global object for a splendid global story. Thank you so much, Nuno.
You're very welcome.